The biggest return on investment that I see and what we really focus on is just tune in to these employees as humans and understand that it's not because they're millennial. It's not because they're working at home moms. All humans want to contribute to something bigger than themselves.
As an employer, your business depends on your staff. They are the backbone of your company. But because you face unique challenges managing your team, you need to have the right resources. On this podcast, industry expert Alex Atwood tackles it all so you don't have to.
Today, I'm so excited to be talking to a leadership pro and the cowgirl queen, Nell Derrick Debevoise. Nell knows that serving her community isn't just about nonprofits. She helps forward-looking leadership understand the impact that they have on their communities and to build the future that they want to see. Today, you'll hear all about Nell, from when she started riding horses to going to the Middle East, being in Palestine, working with all types of marginalized communities, taking that learning, bringing it into corporate America, and just continuing to improve, continuing to iterate, and continuing to cultivate more phases of her already outstanding career. Nell is a senior contributor at Forbes, and she's publishing her book, Going First, early next year. So excited to be talking to her. I know you will really enjoy this show. So let's get it started. Nell, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. I'm so excited to talk to you.
What a pleasure.
Let's go back. Tell me about where you grew up. I want to learn more about you. Tell me about your childhood and sort of what got you excited as you were growing up.
Yeah. So I'll start with one excitement piece. I got influenced to love horses by a classmate of mine in school. We grew up in Hartford, Connecticut, which with all love and respect is kind of a shitty New England city that once had a heyday around insurance and Mark Twain and literature, but by the 80s was just kind of down on its luck. So there weren't a ton of horses around, but this friend of mine was obsessed. And so she was reading Black Beauty and we collected whatever they were called, Briar horses, and it was all very cool. And finally, she convinced her parents that if she could find a carpool buddy, she could ride. And so she pulled me in being like, can your mom ever drive? And my mom was self-employed. And so it actually worked out quite well. And so from 12 is when we finally pressured the parents into letting us do it. From 12 through college, I got to ride horses basically once a week. I never had my own or anything like that, but once a week. And then during the summers for maybe 1, 2, some, I think even 3 weeks, some years, I would go to camp and just love these big beasts and learning to ride. So
did you find that building a connection with the horse and being able to sort of find your passion in working with horses, is there any correlation there in terms of how you also connect with your peers or how you find passion around things specifically in that? I find that super fascinating.
So much, Alex. Like, it's book number 3 or 4, but I already write Forbes articles about the leadership lessons. So I'm back to riding now as an adult, which is not easy, right? I mean, for a long time, I lived in cities, was working for nonprofits. Like, there wasn't access or money to pay for riding lessons. And very, very happily in the last 3 years, I've gotten back into it. And specifically in the last 18 months with a trainer who I just love, because she has this, what I would say is that she teaches riding in the way that I aspire to teach leadership. And I think in the ways that I do. And so it's really about deep understanding and partnership with the horse, right? And so I have been unlearning what I learned when I was a kid, which was fine and kind of all I knew. But looking back, it was a very command and control style of leadership of the horse. Now, turns out, as a 14-year-old and 92 pounds or whatever, I was not commanding and controlling any 1,200-pound horse. But it was the way that the trainers trained the horses up enough to kind of hold the illusion for our 45-minute lessons. And that's how we learned to ride. And so now kind of going back and undoing such that I can start to feel in my seat, like which leg is coming up and whether I want that leg to come up more or faster or move left or right. It's just this incredible version of partnership, which is, I think, what leadership should be. So yes, there's massive correlation.
Yes. And it's beyond verbal. There's a communication there that's a very deep communication. And I find that specifically if I'm having a conversation or if I'm working with somebody, there's a level there that is beyond the verbal. There's a level there that we really get enrolled in the other human being or the horse. And we start to see when that leg is going up. And that to me is key in leadership as well. So let's cut over to sort of how you started to get involved with nonprofits and where you started to become somebody who really looks at leadership and enrolling teams and all that. So tell me about after you got into college and you started to go there, where did your passion start to form around what you're doing now?
Yeah. And so I wound my way through a few different experiences in not-for-profits, in a public sector role, doing essentially leadership development. One role was an amazing opportunity to manage a network of youth activists. Mm-hmm. So about 60 mayors in our network appointed two young leaders and activists, and then I got to support them and project manage their dreams and their projects in their local communities from Sao Paulo to the Philippines to the US and Canada, around Europe and Africa. Really amazing opportunity. And then I did a more direct service job where I actually helped set up a community center in the West Bank of Palestine and work with refugee women and their young children, mental health and economic development, which between building something from zero to something that still exists today, and then that direct service work was really quite powerful. And so very early on, you know, we're running this program and we have international funders and all the things. And so I'm like trying to keep the dots, I's dotted and the T's crossed. And I'm like, okay, so here are attendance sheets. It's a template. Use if you want to change it or whatever, but here's a template for attendance sheets. And Alex, like weeks in, I'm like, okay, so where are we at on attendance? Are people coming? Are they not? Are they falling off? When do they fall off? And they're like, oh, we haven't been able to keep attendance. And I'm like,
oh, wow.
What? Like, four-year-old, like, we need to know where these children are, much less any impact. I mean, forget about like impact metrics, right?
Yeah.
And so I'm like ripping my hair out and talking to my colleague who manages the teachers. And I'm like, what? So this battle truly continued for a year of like me just being like, we just need to know what children are here and what days, like, when. How is this such a thing? Anyway, I learned so much about culture and expectations and restrictions and logistics and everything that colors such a simple function. And finally, when we broke through was when I started, we didn't have an American office. And so I was there kind of full time for the first 2 years probably, and then started traveling more. And when I would go away for like 5 or 6 weeks and then come back for 5 or 6 weeks, the progress we made was just so much more peaceful and happy because I was able to kind of check in and what's this going and give some feedback, make some requests, share what I'd been learning outside, hear what was going on at home, try to troubleshoot, and then go away for a while and let it like marinate and learn and evolve and adapt and make it theirs. And I would come back and they're like, so we have this great solution for attendance. It's like, thank goodness. Isn't that interesting?
So you gave a little bit of autonomy. And
a bit, yes.
Do you like that?
Do
you think it was you leaving the circumstance, you leaving and then coming back for you to be able to see the amount of progress that was actually happening? In other words, you were so deep in the weeds, you were so deep in the woods that you weren't able to see that things were actually moving forward? Or do you think it was actually giving that autonomy there to allow them to be able to work through that?
I think it was the latter. Yeah. It was, you know, the autonomy. It was a little bit of that vacuum of like not just going upstairs to ask things every time, you know, and kind of hearing an idea, working through it, again, making it their own, trying it a bit. And rather than feeling the pressure of we need an answer tomorrow or in staff meeting next week or something, which even if I wasn't saying that, my mere presence had that effect.
So at what point did you make the transition to corporate America, to the for-profit, you know, capitalistic drive?
Yeah.
When did that happen? Tell us a little bit about that journey.
Yeah. So the bridge was business school, right? I was actually supposed to go to business school. I was going to go over to Palestine for 6 months and do some research and help this founder get things started, and had an offer to go to business school after that. And I just fell in love. I was too deep into this project, the community. And so I kind of said no to business school at that point. But 5 years later, despite these moments and these learnings, I was frustrated by the constraints that felt like they were really put on our growth by the structure of nonprofits and the way that they're funded and managed. So I was like, I do want to go to business school and just figure out like what's on the other side of this curtain. And so I enrolled in a program that was executive, so I could keep working between New York and London. So it was really global, which I wanted. And that began kind of my transition out. I kept working for the nonprofit throughout just to kind of get the succession down and make sure everything was sustainable and happy without me. And then after that, I was like, well, if ever I'm going to get a real job in New York or in corporate America, this would be the moment with my freshly minted Columbia London Business School degrees. And I looked and nobody wanted me. I didn't want anyone. You know, I didn't feel like at that time, and this is 10 years ago, right? But at that time, I wasn't seeing people truly coming at purpose and impact and justice with profitability and business, truly in even weight. And look, people have been doing that for a long time. So I don't want to say that no one was doing it, but I couldn't find a spot, a role for myself somewhere that I felt like was really doing that. And so I started my company, as all arrogant, creative entrepreneurs are wont to do. I registered Inspiring Capital and had some consulting work that kind of carried me over to get started and started the journey, which I'm obviously happy to share more about that. But that was the transition. That was kind of how and why it happened.
The classic entrepreneurial story, right? So if it's not there, you build it, you create it, you manifest it. And so came Inspiring Capital. So, and that's a great lead into what I want to learn about now. I want you to tell me about the challenges that you faced when you were founding Inspiring Capital. Share a little bit about that. And I'd like to hear sort of a lot of the differences that, well, obviously there's major differences because now you're working for potential shareholders and profit, possibly for the sake of profit. So how do you start to synthesize in the inspiration? How do you start to synthesize in your purpose behind this new business?
Yeah. Honestly, for better or worse, right? Because we've had our struggles over the years, as many, most companies do. But honestly, it actually didn't shift my approach, really. Like, we registered as a B Corp 4 months after starting the work, which you can't even do now. They want you to wait a little longer to get your feet under you. But at the time, there wasn't any holding time. And when we submitted all of our materials, the audit team came back and said, actually, we want you to like bring some of this down. Like, you're doing too much. It's not going to be sustainable. So that was the first message that like, wait a minute, there are other constraints and considerations here. But to me, there was no question in my mind that what we were doing, which was really training leaders at that time, kind of young leaders, MBAs and rising professionals, to be purposeful and to be conscious of their impact in the world through whatever role they did, whether it was investment banking or marketing, creative work or nonprofits or Peace Corps or anything else. And I just felt like the more of that we did, the more good we did in the world. And presumably now we were getting paid for that. And so the better job we did, the more we got paid, and the more we did, the more impact we had, right? So that felt like a very authentic and aligned kind of model. Mm-hmm. Now, what's difficult and the challenge is, particularly with me coming at it from that like very mission-driven opportunity or approach, is that we do not financially value social impact in the same way that we value financial impact in certainly the US, but mostly I would say in global capitalism, right? And so a lot of the entities that were looking to work with us for the training and for these professionals were nonprofits or were B Corps who didn't have the profit margin or the funding to necessarily pay what would be a very reasonable market value that we were able to charge an American Express or a Campbell's Soup or, you know, some of these larger corporate clients that we have worked with over the years. Mm-hmm. And so that has led to really thin margins that at some point resulted in several layoffs and just challenge for the business to really grow, as well as it's been interesting over these last few years, but people's readiness or willingness to invest in this notion of purpose and why am I doing this and how do my employees connect to our work, which to my mind is very much a bottom line investment because then they stay, they work harder, they work happier, they work more collaboratively, like, and the research is all out there to show it, but it's not quite, most leaders and managers don't quite feel that yet, or their boss doesn't, right? And so to get people to invest in that has been difficult for a number of reasons. And again, I think part of it is I'm so inclined to lead with the aspirational piece of this, of the impact we can have on the world, rather than you will save 22% in recruiting costs because of this employer brand that will help you build, which arguably might be a quicker way to get some of our contracts approved.
Yeah. So it sounds like you have to speak Wall Street, right? You have to speak to how that sort of that leadership thinks, right? While at the same time, making sure that they're building purpose, because ultimately, and especially now, I don't want to say post-pandemic, but post this major shift, what I've discovered out of lots and lots of conversations with business leaders is that the motivation has changed slightly. And I think people staying home, people suddenly being able to have a little bit more freedom with their time and how they spend it, I think they've, at least from what I've heard, there is a shift there, whether you like it or not, and it's here to stay. And so when you're working with businesses that are disconnected, or where the people in the businesses are disconnected from their purpose, what do you, like, two-part question, what do you see as being the biggest missing there in terms of just pragmatic, like, good business? Like, if your team members are disconnected from the purpose of the business, where do you see that perhaps impacting the bottom line? And what do you advise business leaders to do to connect frontline workers, managers, with the purpose of the business, or with a greater purpose on how the business can impact the world?
Yeah, brilliant positioning and question. So to the first point, of course, like, the headline right now is retention. People leave. People just aren't going to do it, right? And it may be because they have something lined up. It may be because they think they're never going to work a 9-to-5 again, whatever. But they are just leaving. Whereas our company, I mean, look, everybody's having that to some extent, which is fine. Not all churn is bad. You know, not everyone at any given moment is right for your company. You're growing, they're growing. And so some of that is natural and healthy. But when we see the undesirable churn, that's, I really think, a true red flag to the lack of helping connect to purpose. And the second biggest thing, right, if this were like Family Feud, and that's like the first answer with 60% of votes, the next is friction and tension. Right? Because especially in a moment like these last few years, when there's homeschooling and there's stress and there's ill parents and there's racism and there's political distinction and difference. I mean, whoa, the reasons for friction are many. And so when you have that common sense of a North Star, it's a lot easier to be like, you know what? My kids are sick. I'm worried. I don't think I agree with Alex's politics, but we're both trying to get there. And so actually I can swallow that comment that kind of annoyed me, or that I wasn't sure what he meant by, because he's still here, I'm still here, and we're trying to get there. And so let's move on to what's important here. And that's a really powerful thing that I see with clients, is really feeling that trust and that the ease of collaboration and kind of fluidity happen, which is especially in a remote work environment or a hybrid, is really powerful to have. So there's others kind of down the board, but I think those are the two worth calling out. And then in terms of where to start, the biggest recommendation I have, and where I think we're uniquely positioned in the work we do is so impactful, is actually to start with the human, right? And so most companies that we work with at this point have a corporate purpose. Like, that was sort of the work of 2005 to 2008, right? There were some great branding companies that did it, and a lot of that work was done really well. Some of it, frankly, was, I think, done quite shoddily or superficially. So that's kind of there. And that's fine. It's important to have a purpose, for sure. And many of those could use revising or refreshing, and that's all cool. But actually, the biggest ROI, return on investment, that I see, and what we really focus on, is first, just tune in to these employees as humans and understand that it's not because they're millennial. It's not because they're working at home moms. It's not because they just happen to like go to a dippy school. All humans want to contribute to something bigger than themselves, i.e. have a purpose, right? That is just universal. And our system, our schools, our colleges, our employers do a dismal job of talking about it and cultivating it and helping people refine it. And it's not obvious, right? You're not born with it. Nobody, you know, you don't get it with your college diploma. Like, you're welcome. Here's your purpose statement. And so that's the magic that I see, is helping people to connect to, what do I care about? We have a dashboard. There's all these different 6 areas in which I can have impact and connect to purpose. Some of those are at work, but others are not. And so by an employer showing that level of investment and autonomy, like, we get that you're a human, and then exploring how does that connect to our corporate purpose and what you do here for us, then I can get really jazzed about it in a way that doesn't just require me to drink your Kool-Aid and march in line, but it becomes this really authentic partnership. And that's what's really sticky.
Yeah. So what I hear in that is really connecting with the human being. And I had a conversation not dissimilar from this with my good friend Keith Ferrazzi. He wrote a book recently called Leadership Without Authority. And in that book, he looks at leadership, and this is something we discussed on my podcast, as leaders being the humble Sherpa, to be able to allow for the peer-to-peer relationships to foster. And so eloquently pointed out, to not just sort of have everyone march in the line of the sense of purpose of the of sort of the stale corporate mission, but to really build a sense of relatedness to your teams, to really understand them as human beings, and not to understand them as, oh, that's a working mother, or that is a whatever, right? No, that's not what it is. These are human beings. They have a sense of purpose. They have something in their own lives that they want to fulfill beyond what potentially that their demographic might say. Yeah. And so, yeah, that is brilliant. And have you seen significant shifts in that space in working from the 1990s and building your business and now where you are today in terms of working with top leadership? Have you seen that progression? Has it made any material impact on any of the clients that you're working with?
For sure. I mean, I think that, again, so many people have been leading this way for a long time. It's, of course, not mainstream, but people have been doing it. There's nothing new under the sun, but it is spreading. And it was, I think there's a lot of trends that COVID did not start, but accelerated and really has shined a light on, which I think is incredibly exciting. Obviously, notwithstanding massive loss and suffering, which is unfortunate, to put it mildly, especially how unequally it was distributed. So now I think really what we're at is that good leaders get it, right? Like, companies that are doing well right now get this and are thinking about it. I think the next exciting frontier is making that real for the marketing account manager on a Tuesday afternoon, right? We refer a lot to Tuesday afternoons. It's like, okay, you have this retreat, or you have this brand on the cafeteria or on your background or wherever you have it. But what about on a Tuesday afternoon? Like, what does it really look and feel like? Again, throughout the organization, right? For the VPs, but also for the new hire and for that person's assistant, right? Like, everyone needs to feel, this is who I am. This is my sense of purpose, evolving though it may be. And this is why and how that connects, right, to this organization. It doesn't have to be a perfect overlap, right? You're not looking for 100% like, oh, that's my purpose too. How perfect. But it's this Venn diagram of like, my purpose is really the health of the oceans for my grandchildren and their grandchildren. Okay, great. So I happen to work at this company that's really taken single-use plastic out of our snack room and given employees a subsidy to buy reusable plastic and less plastic meals. Awesome. We happen to do car parts by day, right? Or whatever it might be. But we have this element of our business that is putting less plastic car parts into the ocean. Or I don't know, that's a sort of a silly example that I don't know enough about to really fully carry out.
It was a good example.
It's that sense of like, It's not that like I was born to make reusable car parts, right? But it's like, here is this cool company that pays me and I learn things and I'm part of a team and aligns with my values in this way. And then I volunteer, I'm on this board, or I do cleanups at my local beach in the other part of the Venn diagram, right? So I think that's, sometimes employers are scared that like, if it's not a perfect match, they'll all leave and we'll be revealed. And it's much more, people don't want to leave their jobs. Ultimately, it's really costly in terms of time and energy and emotion. So If you just make that autonomy, that openness for people to connect the dots and realize that actually there are these sync ups, that's the shift that I'm seeing, which is exciting.
So give them the opportunity to find purpose in what they're doing. Allow them to be able to really understand how the purpose and the mission of the business can relate into their purpose, right? So that sort of connects things very well. And one thing, first of all, you have amazing energy as you talk about all of these different experiences. And what I see is that it's clear to me that you don't stay stagnant. You change things up, right? If you're going in one direction, you're ready to change things up and you're ready to take on new challenges. So tell me what's next. What's the new phase of your life or Inspiring Capital? Like, what do you see as the next big thing as we're going into the, wow, it's 2022 already. Yeah. As we're going into the new year, the new decade, what's there for you now?
Yeah. Thank you. That's a great question. You are a bit of a seer because there are some exciting things on the horizon. So the first really big one that's top of mind is that we spun out. So we had a recruiting business and a training business in Inspiring Capital. And we've completed now the spin out of the recruiting business into a new not-for-profit coming full circle in my journey that does recruiting of purpose-driven and diverse talent. And so that organization is called the Purposeful Growth Institute. And it launched in August. Sort of a soft launch coming bigger in the new year. And so we partner with purpose-driven employers who want this kind of young, purpose-driven, diverse leadership in their ranks. So that's been really exciting to see. I think it's such a growing area. And we really resolved that we did want to put it in a not-for-profit to really cement that mission obligation, right? Recruiting is obviously a kind of fast and furious field. And we really wanted to lock in the mission so that it couldn't become sort of hijacked by profit seeking, which we're not shy. We're charging fees and making money, but it is all dedicated to that mission. So that's step one. Step two, the book, capital T, capital B, which should be out this spring. The aim was actually October of this past year, but the publisher put me on a mandate to interview 100 CEOs and chief people officers who are purpose-driven. And so at 137 interviews, I was like, wait, this is too good. I need 6 more months to like build all the data and finish the book. So doing that wrap up now and should be out by March, April. And then the third is still in the works. So nothing public to announce, but some really exciting work expanding the reach of our leadership development programs and just really responding to what we've heard in those 137 interviews and looking to make products and offerings that meet better the time, which is changing so fast.
Excellent. So I'm sure you have a lot of data from all of those interviews. And I can't wait to read the book. I can't wait to see what comes out of this. Amazing, amazing. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Alex.
Scroll down if you want more information about Inspiring Capital, about Nell, about her upcoming book. Thank you so much for coming on the show today. I have the utmost gratitude. So excited to see where you go with your career, how you make an impact on the world. More leaders like you are absolutely necessary. And I see that they are starting to come. There's a new wave. There's a wave that's slowly coming, but surely transforming the way for-profit companies work and really putting mission and purpose above profit. So thank you so much for being a part of that wave. And thank you for being on the show.
Absolutely, Alex. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you for tuning in to Off the Clock. Don't miss next week's tips around innovation and HR. Subscribe to the show. You can catch us on YouTube, Apple, iHeart, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. Until next time, be kind and thrive.